Think about the last time you made just a terrible, impulsive decision in the heat of the moment.
Oh, yeah, we've all been there.
Right. You know the feeling, your heart rate spikes, the situation feels chaotic, and you do something just entirely out of character.
Exactly.
Well, you probably didn't realize it, but you weren't just using a poetic metaphor. You were perfectly and accurately citing the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of microscopic
Which
thermodynamics.
is pretty incredible to think about.
It really is. So welcome to the deep dive. Today we are exploring a wildly fascinating interactive primer we've sourced. It's titled The Thermodynamics of Everyday Language and Logic.
Yeah.
And our mission today is to uncover a pretty incredible truth. Basically, without even realizing it, you are constantly describing the literal physical laws of the universe in your daily conversations.
Yeah, the premise of this source material is just brilliant. I mean, it takes the core tenets of thermodynamics, so the four laws, energy efficiencies, the slow drift toward thermal equilibrium, and it basically overlays them onto the everyday idioms we use to talk about our emotions, our relationships, our work. We think we're just making up clever sayings, but human language actually possesses this deep, intuitive grasp of physics.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get into the heavy, unbreakable rules that govern the universe, we have to establish what temperature actually is, like on a microscopic level.
Right, because it's not just a number on a thermometer.
Exactly. To understand how you operate like a thermodynamic machine, we have to look at the tiniest gears turning inside.
Yeah, so when you touch something and perceive it as hot, what your nerves are actually feeling is the average kinetic energy of countless tiny microscopic collisions.
So things just crashing into each other.
Right, at a molecular level, things are constantly bouncing around. If you chill those particles, the motion slows down. But if you heat them up, they bounce harder, faster.
Wow.
And the walls of whatever container they're in actually feel the literal physical push of that increased energy.
The operative word there being average, right? Because the source material brings up this concept, the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution.
Yes, exactly.
Which is basically a statistical way showing that at any given temperature, say standard room temperature, not every single particle is moving at the exact same speed.
Not at all.
There's a massive cluster of particles moving at whatever the normal speed is for that temperature, but there is also a long tail of incredibly fast outliers.
Yeah, to visualize the mechanics of it, imagine a massive container of nitrogen gas, which is mostly what you're breathing right now.
Okay, got it.
The bulk of those molecules are cruising along at a highly probable, predictable speed. But because they are constantly colliding and transferring energy,
Right.
a small fraction of them get knocked around so violently that they are shot out into that long tail, moving way, way faster than the rest of the group.
So it's like a crowded highway.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, the temperature of the highway is the speed limit that most of the cars are doing, say, 65 miles an hour. But the real chaos, the heat of the moment, is caused by that long tail of erratic speeders weaving through the traffic at 100 miles an hour.
And when one of those erratic speeders inevitably blows a tire, they jump the guardrail.
Yeah.
In a highly energetic state, a microscopic particle does the exact same thing. High kinetic energy means motion is incredibly fast, and that individual particle is suddenly capable of escaping the boundary it was safely sitting in just a millisecond ago.
Which brings a whole new literal meaning to the heat of the moment.
It really does.
When you are highly agitated, your internal energy is spiked, and you are far more likely to jump the guardrail and make a radical boundary-breaking decision.
And the source also points to the exact opposite end of the spectrum with the phrase, cool as a cucumber.
Oh, right.
In physical terms, a low temperature means energy is bound up in low amplitude modes. So the particles might be vibrating slightly, but there is an outward structural stillness.
So when you tell someone to be cool as a cucumber during a stressful meeting, you are literally requesting that they lower their internal kinetic energy so they don't jump a boundary and start yelling.
Exactly. You are grading their thermodynamics.
That's hilarious. But from those millions of tiny erratic collisions, those microscopic cars bouncing off each other on the highway, we get the emergence of strict macroscopic rules, right?
Yeah, entire laws of nature that we simply cannot violate.
So how do bouncing microscopic particles translate into laws we follow in our social lives? Let's look at the first two rules of the game, the zeroth and first laws of thermodynamics.
Right, well, the zeroth law establishes thermal equilibrium. It's basically the foundation of the whole system. The rule simply states that if two separate bodies are in equilibrium with a third body, They are natively in equilibrium with each other.
Okay, so if you connect a freezing cold object to a fiercely hot object,
the universe steps in to correct the imbalance. Energy walks across the bridge between them. The hot side is forced to surrender energy, and the cold side absorbs it until the entire system reaches one unified temperature.
I love the idiom the primer maps this to, meeting in the middle.
Yes.
Think about a grueling compromise in a boardroom or a drawn-out argument with the partner. Neither side gets to keep their extreme position. Both sides bleed energy to the average. As the source beautifully puts it, the room becomes the room.
The individual extremes are always lost to the collective equilibrium. And that surrender is strictly governed by the first law of thermodynamics,
which dictates the absolute conservation of energy.
Exactly. The total energy of an isolated system remains constant. It can transform, it can move, but it cannot be created from nothing, and it cannot be destroyed.
The source material translates the math of the first law into a really mechanical concept for this. Like, if you physically push down on a heavy piston to compress the gas trapped underneath it, you are doing manual work. Because that energy has to go somewhere, the gas absorbs your work and violently heats up.
Right.
But if you reverse it, if you let that hot gas expand and push the heavy piston back up to lift a weight, the gas cools down. It spent its internal heat to do work on the outside world.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is how this mathematical trade-off exactly mirrors our folk wisdom. We say it constantly, you can't get something for nothing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Every joule of energy that warms up one place had to be extracted from another place. The physical books always balance.
Which completely explains letting off steam. We say that when we go for a run after a bad day at work or vent our frustration to a friend.
Right.
But physically, a pressure release valve on a boiler is letting steam perform outward work specifically to lower the dangerous internal energy and pressure inside the tank. You are literally spending internal energy outward to stop the system from exploding.
The human psychological mechanism perfectly mirrors the physical one. You are trading internal pressure for external work.
Okay, so the first law says energy is completely conserved. The books always balance. But if energy is never lost, why can't we just recycle it forever? Why do we ever run out of energy?
Well, that is the ultimate trap of the universe and the harsh reality introduced by the second law.
Ah, okay.
Energy is conserved, but its quality relentlessly degrades. The second law is the law of entropy, which states that in any closed physical system, disorder only ever increases. The primer uses a fantastic visualization for this. Imagine a sealed container split in half by a wall.
Okay.
On the left side, you have 150 bouncing gas particles. On the right side, it's a complete vacuum.
And the second you remove that wall, the gas instantly floods the right side. It spreads out to fill the entire available space.
Crucially, those 150 particles will never, ever spontaneously gather themselves back into that original left half. The process is completely irreversible.
The everyday idiom is you can't unbreak an egg.
Precisely. Macroscopic processes have a preferred direction in time. Entropy is effectively a measure of the number of possible ways a state can be arranged. There is only one specific, highly ordered way an egg is put together perfectly. But there are an astronomical number of ways for it to be scrambled.
Wait, hold on. I need to pause on this egg analogy and make sure I'm wrapping my head around the physics here.
Sure.
Are you saying time's arrow, the fact that we move forward and not backward, is essentially just a massive statistics problem?
Pretty much.
Because the primer mentions that microscopic equations don't actually care which way time runs. A particle bouncing left looks the same as a particle bouncing right.
Yeah, the microscopic mechanics are totally reversible. If you filmed two atoms colliding and played it backward, you'd look completely natural.
So why don't we see eggs reassembling themselves?
The reason we remember the past and not the future, the reason the egg stays broken, is purely statistical probability. The universe is blindly pulling from a bag of available states. The scrambled pile has trillions upon trillions more tickets in it than the whole pile.
Oh, wow.
Entropy only goes up because the universe is playing the ultimate game of chance, and order loses the lottery every single time.
That is mind-blowing. Time is just the universe playing the odds, which leads to the third law, right, which acts as the floor of this entire casino.
Exactly. The third law dictates that as the temperature of a system approaches absolute zero, the entropy of a perfect crystal approaches a fixed, absolute minimum. Motion never fully stops, thanks to quantum mechanics, but it hits the absolute bottom of the well.
And folk physics intuitively understands this limit. We say cold as ice or frozen in place.
Yeah.
The primer even points out that the phrase absolute zero crossed over from sterile laboratory jargon into everyday speech to mean total silence, complete absence of motion or emotion.
The catch is that you can never actually reach it. Absolute zero is an asymptote. Laboratory scientists have built specialized refrigerators that get within a billionth of a degree of absolute zero, but they can never touch the bottom.
Because it just takes too much effort.
Right. Every tiny step closer requires exponentially more work than the last one, to the point of infinity.
So if we absolutely need a temperature difference or a gradient to get any actual work done in this universe, what happens when we push systems to the edge of those differences?
That's where things get incredibly volatile. The primer explores what happens at the boundaries, specifically phase transitions. This is when a substance undergoes a fundamental change in state, like liquid water suddenly flashing into steam.
The idiom we use is in hot water, meaning you're in trouble, because water is perfectly calm and predictable right up until it hits that 100 degrees Celsius boundary, and then suddenly, chaotic boiling begins.
Another one is on thin ice. In thermodynamic terms, when a system is near a phase transition, its free energy landscape becomes precariously flat.
What does that mean, practically?
Think of it like balancing a bowling ball on the very edge of a sheer cliff. It's an unstable equilibrium where one single perturbation, one heavy footstep on the ice, tilts the entire system violently into a totally new state.
And to trigger that reaction, you need activation energy. We call it the spark of an idea. In physics, a match doesn't actually fuel a bonfire. The logs do. The tiny spark simply provides the initial localized energy input needed to clear the barrier. Once the barrier is crossed, the self-sustaining chemical reaction takes over entirely.
But starting the fire is only half the battle. To sustain any useful work, to keep an engine turning or a society functioning, you rely entirely on the heat engine and the Carnot cycle.
Okay.
Sadie Carnot proved that the maximum efficiency of any machine is strictly limited by the temperature gap between its hot power source and its cold exhaust.
You don't even need the math to picture it. If your hot power source is blazing and your cold exhaust sink is freezing, you have a massive gap. The engine acts like a water wheel sitting between a high waterfall and a low river.
Exactly.
The bigger the drop, the more power you can extract as the energy cascades downward.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it underwrites the idiom fire and ice. You need maximum thermodynamic distance to yield the largest potential for work.
But the flip side of that is running out of steam. If your hot reservoir drops in temperature, the gap between the hot source and the cold exhaust shrinks. As the waterfall gets lower and lower, the water wheel spins slower and slower until the water levels are equal. When there is no difference in temperature, the wheel stops. No work can be done.
A system with no differences is a dead system. Whether you are looking at a literal steam turbine, a creative team at a company, or your own personal motivation, without a gradient, there is no forward momentum. It stagnates.
So if you absolutely need a temperature difference to get work done, what happens when the universe naturally tries to erase those differences?
Well, everything inevitably drifts toward that stagnant room temperature. The source dives into Newton's law of cooling to explain this phenomenon. The visual is simple. Think of a fresh steaming cup of coffee sitting on your desk.
Anyone who drinks coffee intuitively knows this law. When you first pour it, the coffee is drastically hotter than the air in the room, so it dumps its heat rapidly. But as it cools down and the gap between the coffee and the room shrinks, the cooling process slows to a crawl. It becomes agonizingly patient.
The primer summarizes it with such brilliant poetry. The first sip burns. The last sip is room temperature regret.
Room temperature regret. I love that. Time is the ultimate agent of equilibration, and we tell people to let it cool off, whether we are talking about a heated argument or a literal bowl of soup. Both things follow the exact same physical curve of exponential decay.
The truly existential question the primer raises is, where does all that heat actually go when the coffee cools? Where does the energy go when the gradients collapse?
Because it can't just disappear.
Right, because energy is conserved. But it cascades downward through usable forms until it eventually ends up as ambient heat.
The primer refers to ambient heat as the graveyard of every joule. And the statistics they list for how much of our global energy budget simply vanishes into this graveyard are, frankly, staggering.
They really are. Let's look at the mechanical reasons behind some of these numbers. Take an old school incandescent light bulb. We think of it as a tool for creating light, but physically, it's only about 5% efficient at producing photons.
5%.
Yeah, the other 95% of the electricity just leaves the tungsten filament as infrared heat. Your lamp is basically a miniature space heater that happens to glow by accident.
Wait, 95% is just wasted as heat? Even an LED lamp, which feels incredibly advanced, is only 40% efficient. 60% still bleeds into the graveyard. What about the engines we rely on?
Well, a standard gasoline engine is roughly 25% efficient at translating the explosive energy of combustion into mechanical rotation at the wheels.
Okay.
The rest goes out the exhaust pipe, gets absorbed by the liquid coolant, or is lost to the friction of moving metal parts.
I know diesel engines do a bit better than that, closer to 40%, because they compress the fuel much harder.
They do lift that Carnot efficiency bound, but the trade-off is brutal. Pushing the engine to those extreme temperatures physically tears apart the nitrogen molecules in the air, creating toxic NOx pollution. You can squeeze more efficiency out of the system, but the physics extract a heavy toll somewhere else.
Even our clean energy has strict physical limits, right? A commercial solar panel is generally around 22% efficient.
Mm-hmm.
The primer explains that there are theoretical ceilings based on the materials we use, like silicon, where the panel simply cannot absorb certain wavelengths of sunlight, meaning the absolute maximum efficiency is capped around 33%.
Wind turbines face similar hard boundaries. A modern turbine captures about 45% of the wind's kinetic energy. There's a physics principle called the Betz limit that proves you can never extract more than 59.3% of the wind's power.
Why is that?
Because if you captured 100%, the air would completely stop moving behind the blades, blocking any new wind from coming through. And interestingly, wind energy is technically just a byproduct of solar energy. Yeah, the wind only blows because the sun heats the Earth's surface unevenly. Wind is just a tiny 0.1% reshaped chunk of the sun's thermal budget.
Out of all these statistics, the one that broke my brain was photosynthesis. You look at a massive forest and assume nature has perfected energy capture over billions of years, but most plants convert a measly 1% of the sunlight that hits them into actual biomass.
The mechanical reason for that is fascinating. You'd think plants would be perfectly adapted to absorb all light, but they completely ignore massive chunks of the solar spectrum.
Like green light.
Exactly. They mostly absorb red and blue light. Green light just bounces right off their leaves, which is why they look green to human eyes.
Yeah.
By rejecting that light, their theoretical maximum efficiency plummets immediately. The molecular conversion inside the leaf is highly efficient, but the whole plant economics are terrible because they waste so much energy just running their own cellular maintenance.
Here is where it gets really interesting for you listening. Because you are a biological machine too. A highly trained elite cyclist pedaling a bike is only about 20% efficient at turning the chemical energy of a carbohydrate into mechanical pedal work.
Just 20%.
The other 80% of the energy you burn, it surfaces as pure body heat. That is literally why you sweat when you are biking uphill.
Yeah.
Your body has to forcefully dump 80% of its energy into the graveyard of every joule just to keep your internal organs from overheating and failing.
It forces a phenomenal perspective shift. Everything we do, every machine we build, every plant that grows, every thought you have is just a temporary, highly inefficient detour on energy's inevitable, irreversible journey toward ambient room temperature.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the thermodynamics of language, it's pretty incredible to reflect on how deeply our idioms understand these unyielding laws.
Absolutely.
We describe an angry person holding back their temper as a slow burn, which perfectly mirrors combustion proceeding at a low restricted rate when oxygen is limited.
We give people the cold shoulder, deliberately acting as a thermal insulator to prevent any emotional heat from flowing across our personal boundaries.
And perhaps the most relevant phrase for our modern lives, we say we are burnt out.
Yeah, the term burnt out isn't merely a psychological description of feeling tired. It perfectly details a physical system whose finite internal fuel reservoir has been entirely consumed. Once that last joule of usable energy is gone, the system can no longer do any work.
It's empty.
Right. The crucial takeaway from the physics is that recovery isn't just about resting. It literally requires a resupply of new energy from the outside. You have to take in fuel to rebuild the gradient.
You cannot get something for nothing.
The books always balance.
We started today by talking about how you're constantly citing physics in your daily life. But the implications of this source material go so much deeper than just pointing out clever metaphors. It exposes the reality of how you operate within the universe's strict accounting system.
Yeah, it really does.
Since every single action you take, every pedal on a bike, every compromise in a meeting, even just listening to this deep dive right now and having a tiny spark of an idea, physically increases the irreversible entropy of the entire universe. What does it mean to spend your finite usable energy wisely before your own cup of coffee hits room temperature?